Welcome to Black Armada Tales, an actual play podcast. My name is Josh Fox. My pronouns are he, him.
Hello, I'm Becky Annison. My pronouns are she, her.
And I'm James Torrance. My pronouns are he, him.
Hi, folks. I'm Nick Bate. My pronouns are he, him.
Hi, my name's Sue Elliott. My pronouns are she, her.
We've just completed our Apocalypse Keys campaign, and this episode is us discussing what games we might like to play next. We will cover a bunch of games that we think sound exciting, a bunch of games that have been mentioned on Twitter. It's a really good discussion, so let's go. So, first proposal for a game to run is anything by Yoon-Ha Lee. Holy shit. Yoon-Ha Lee's got an itch page that Nick linked in the chat.
I know, you should put that in the show notes.
Heretical Geese.
Oh, I love Yoon-Ha Lee.
Interactive fiction where you play Cheris at Kell Academy. Yes, please.
Yep.
And that, well, Entropy Soldiers, a TTRPG of camaraderie and destruction. That sounds up your street, Becky.
I'm going to be all over that itch page when this session is over.
I feel like it's a little bit of a stealth itch page too.
Stealth?
I don't feel like it's. I feel like we know that, say, Kieran Gillen is making role-playing games.
Oh, you mean the fact that, like, Yoon-Ha Lee has an itch page and we didn't know about it?
Yeah.
Totally.
Sneaky.
You know that Yoon-Ha Lee wrote Gideon the Ninth fanfic.
You just said that, like, before the break.
I know I did, but he has a fanfic account on A Room of Our Own, like something of our own.
Well, I, for one, am disappointed that Yoon-Ha Lee designs role-playing games, because I'd hoped that we could write to him and say, please let us write a game of your books.
It's worth a shot, you know.
I mean, yeah.
And if you do, I know a freelancer who is reliable. And cheap. And so that's two of the three pillars.
What's the third?
Good.
Oh, well. That's, yeah. Two out of three ain't bad, eh?
Yeah.
All right, games. Let's talk about games, baby.
Do you know what I'm going to say about games? Which is
for or against.
For or against. It's really just to put everybody on notice that at the moment I'm going through a serious yearning for some sci-fi.
Oh god, me too. Like real bad.
Should we start with the theme of sci-fi then and give everybody the opportunity to get that out of their system?
Just really digging sci-fi at the moment. I'm not even reading any sci-fi. No, that's not true. I'm halfway through Leviathan Wakes. But I'm like, I always have like seven books on the go at once, so that doesn't really prove anything. But like, I'm having a real kind of, I'm really on a place in sci-fi moment.
Was there a trigger, do you think? This is probably a side conversation.
Was there a trigger? I don't know.
I feel like I hadn't read any sci-fi for a while and was starting to feel that urge, that yearning. And then I saw Dune and I was just
I was
done.
Just going to say Dune, because I went to see it when it came out. I've been about for a few weeks, I think. I went to see it and I was like, oh man, I really want some sci-fi.
I think I've just realised something, which is that you don't have a background level yearning to play sci-fi, and that's why you're having to come up with reasons for it to have started.
Is that your secret, Josh? Do you always wish you were playing sci-fi?
I was just sitting there thinking, what are they talking about? Why? Oh, I see. Well, let's get into it. Come on. Stealing the Throne. Tell us about Stealing the Throne, Nick. Or maybe one of us should tell you about Stealing the Throne since it's your game.
Oh, yeah, do that.
Yeah, it's all right, I guess. It's kind of... I could do that. Like, I wrote a hack of it, so I guess I understand it reasonably well. Stealing the Throne is a one-shot friendly, in fact, one-shot mandatory, I guess, game about heist. But it's a heist with a difference. You are stealing a thousand-year-old... mech, and that is the premise of the game. If that excites you, you're going to like this game. It uses simple sort of cards based mechanic to enable you to like quickly move through the heist in a really light way, in a kind of semi GM-ful way. You kind of take turns at doing the GM bit, and really cleverly skips bits of character creation that you don't need, because the game just assumes you're going to have the right skills for the heist and lets you improv those skills when you need them. And yeah, and it I feel like I'm just doing a little advert for your game here, Nick, but genuinely the thing that's always most impressed me about Stealing the Throne is that you can play it in 2 hours and you can reliably play it in 2 hours. And I don't think there's very many games where that's reliably true. There's plenty of games where you can try and hammer it to get to 2 hours, but you don't need to do that with Stealing the Throne. You just play it and it will run in 2 hours. So it's a beautiful little game.
Thank you.
Also, it comes with a load of cool mechs.
Yeah.
And secretly, it's also a space opera game.
Sorry. Secretly.
Well, you know, talk all about heists and giant robots, but also space opera.
I feel like it would put us on, which is a piece of Familect in the Anison Fox household, that when you are hungry for dinner, you want something to put you on, which means...
Is that Familect? I thought everybody said that.
No, it's definitely Familect. I never heard it before I met you.
I need something to put me on, come on.
Yeah, never heard it before I met you.
That's not something... I'm not even quite sure what you're saying.
So what it would be is if the...
Appetizer?
If the kids come and say, I'm hungry, I need something to put me on, I will give them an apple and then say, it'll be 30 minutes and then dinner will be ready.
That means something that you're...
To tide you over?
Yeah, to tide you over. Tide you over. That's what it means.
Something that you eat to take the edge off your hunger while you're waiting for your main meal.
I had no idea. I just thought that was something everyone said.
No, it's Familect.
Yes, I think it might be that.
So I think that it's a game to put us on for a bigger space game, because it's a two-hour one-shot. It'll tide us over. It'll tide us over. Take the edge off our appetites. I'm grossly assuming that everybody else is interested in playing space, rather than it being just me and Nick and Josh.
Hey, that's a majority. Fuck the other two. They can do whatever they like.
This is not a democracy, is it?
I feel like in some ways, James was playing a space opera in our last game.
Yeah.
That is true.
That's James's secret. He's always actually playing in a space opera, regardless.
Call of Cthulhu, yeah, no. A dilettante from space. I'm very good with things being in space.
Everything should be space, I agree.
How are you feeling about space, Sue?
I'm pro-space.
It's unanimous.
Our kid Rafi says he wants to have a telescope for Christmas so that he can point it at Mars and see the Curiosity rover. I'm like, that's adorable, but I think that you're overestimating how powerful that telescope can be. But if we could do that, I totally would.
Oh, I'm going to say another space game.
Go on.
So I was reading through the games that people suggested on Twitter. Thank you, everyone who suggested a game on Twitter. And I had a look at something called Celestial Crescent, which is part of the... Is it IndieZine or is it a different collection of games that done by the San Gennaro co-op?
So the IndieZine and San Gennaro are two different things. San Gennaro is, I think, now defunct and replaced with the Far Horizons co-op, yeah. I think.
Oh, yes, I think you're right. So... In fact, I think I noticed that on the itch page. But anyway... I will put a link to the thing that it's in the show notes. I can't actually remember right now. But the game is... It's Sumerian themed, right? But it's space opera.
Wow.
And I think what they've kind of done is glommed together Spelljammer with Sumerian myth. That's the fictionally what they've done. And then mechanically, they've glommed together Forged in the Dark with the One Roll engine. And there may be other influences as well. I have not been able to read it in massive depth. But you're playing like a crew of, say, smugglers on board a, you know, what I take from inference to be a spelljammer ship in mythic Sumeria. Yeah, that's kind of... there's a little blurb that I got. Sumerian-themed traders, mercenaries, pirates and ambassadors plying the space routes between planets. I thought that sounded quite cool. And the reason I thought you would like it, Nick, is because you were saying you'd really love to do Forged in the Dark and you'd really love to do, Scum and Villainy, but that it was maybe a bit too Star Wars for you. And I thought, well, this is basically that, but a lot fucking less Star Wars.
A lot less Star Wars. Yeah, that sounds cool. I'm into this thing where Well, I guess I'm into, I suppose everyone is, mash two things together and mash space opera and Sumerian myth together. That feels like fun to me.
James, tell us about Sumerian myth. I find it inconceivable that you don't have opinions on it.
What I know, I have instantly forgotten. James Holloway's excellent RPG podcast, Monster Man, has a, you know, if you subscribe to the Patreon, you get his bonus podcast, Patron Deities, where he uses the D&D's Demigods and Deities and Demigods as a framework for talking in a very informed fashion about various mythologies. So I'm pretty sure that he did go through Sumerian mythology in that blow by blow, and I listened to it with great appreciation while I was washing the dishes, and then I forgot everything. The bits that I can remember are just based on what's in Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash, although that might be like Babylonian, you know, I don't closely differentiate my Mesopotamian civilizations.
Oh, I have that problem too.
The phrase, the Nam Shob of Enki, recurring quite a bit in Snow Crash, that's what I know.
Do you remember, Becky, in we had a car journey once where we ended up listening to a children's story retelling of the Epic of Gilgamesh.
I do remember that car journey and that children's story.
Did you have children in the car, or were you just...
Yeah. So we downloaded a load of... there are various podcasts which do stories for children. I can't remember which one. Story Nori, maybe it was, I think. And... so I just downloaded, we were about to go, and I knew we were going to need some material to keep the kids entertained, so I frantically downloaded a load of Story Nori and other children's storytelling podcasts, and it just so happened that the one that came up was the Epic of Gilgamesh, which I had not expected. I thought, oh, they're not going to enjoy this at all. It was awesome.
Do you think that's why Raffi is enjoying you reading Quorum to him so much? He's already had kind of a grounding in bloodthirsty myth-making.
Nonsense myth, yeah, maybe.
There were these little cartoon strips in the German textbooks that we used to learn German in high school, telling an epic story. And I only realised as an adult, much, much later in my life, that it's Wagner's Ring Cycle in comic strip form in German textbooks.
Whoa, there's a lot of layers to that onion. Isn't there just...
Becky, you have a space opera game, or a sci-fi game in your back pocket, right?
So I kind of do. It's not. I wouldn't say it's a space opera game so much. So I've been looking at After the War by Alastair Stewart and Jason Pitra, and I've been looking at it for a while. I remember when it first came out thinking, oh, that looks like it's up my alley, buying it and then putting it in with all my other PDF role-playing games to read later. Except I did, in fact, read it later, much to my surprise, because I don't usually get around to the things in the to-read pile. And I've recently read it, and I'm really... the setting seems to me just incredibly grabby and quite different, I think, to other spacey or sci-fi games out there, or other sci-fi properties out there. And I know it riffs a little bit off The Expanse and a little bit off Firefly, but it really is its own thing. And props to Alastair Stewart for that, because I think that he crafted a lot of that setting, and the system is definitely from Jason Pitcher's brain. So the concept is that there was a union of sort of Terrans, Martians, who were humans who had colonised Mars, Belters, obviously from The Expanse, and a bunch of alien races. And they were kind of like a union or a federation, I suppose, but it wasn't like federation-y. It was more expansive in terms of that flavour of that history. And then the war happened. And the war was the song. The song was a sort of memetic virus which infected people and turned them into a sort of like a brainwashed hive mind, or part of a brainwashed hive mind. And they became known as choristers of the song. And their job was to transmit the song to other people until everybody in the universe was united in the song. But it had kind of taken over everybody's brains. So a big war was being fought against the song by this kind of union. And it wasn't going terribly well. And then the human kind of science research people created a memetic virus to destroy the song. And if the song is all about sort of conformity and passivity and obedience, they created something called Tormenta, which from reading it seems to turn people into Reavers from Firefly. But the idea was that they seeded a whole bunch of human beings with the Tormenta virus and then sent them out into the heart of the song and let the two viruses smash each other to pieces. So there's an awful lot of kind of war crimes and bad stuff in the history, and the characters are all intended to have a past which has got some trauma in it, although how much we, if we played it, we wanted to lean into that or not, you know, we can discuss that, I suppose. And the reason I don't want to put anybody off, because I know that kind of these are tough times, and I had a Last Fleet campaign fall over because nobody wanted to play a last remnants of humanity in the middle of COVID, which I totally understand.
Fair.
Yeah. But the idea is that you are all now living on the new cradle of community and trying to build a new place and a new way of being, and that the aliens are there and the Belters are there and the Martians are there and there are humans there, and you're trying to create your own communities, and there are other communities around that you interact with, and but the always in the back of your mind, while you're trying to create a community on a new world which might itself have all sorts of weird and wonderful things and slightly scary things about it that you don't know about yet. I mean, it could be LV-14, but hopefully not. People still have LV-426. I always say LV-14 and I always get it wrong. Urgh! Thank you, Nick. Why do I think it's LV-14? Anyway, the people who are infected with the song still have remnants of the song in them, and people who are infected with Tormenta still have remnants of Tormenta in them, and that the idea being that at any point, if people get too aggressive or if people get too conformist or obedient and stuff, then those kind of can re-establish themselves, and that infection could get re-established, and you could have an outbreak of either of those two in this place because it's never really gone away. And I think that's a really interesting idea to play with, that there were these, you know, the Tormenta was practically a war crime, if not definitely a war crime, in order to defeat the song. And the kind of part of the kind of the legacy and the trauma of it all is that you're living with the knowledge that at any point it might come back again. God, that sounds really dark, doesn't it? It is a game of a science fiction game of mimetic horror, so you know. But yeah, and so I've just been really enjoying reading that, and I think the system's really interesting. It's its own thing. It's not like here's a PBTA. I'm not going to tell you about how many dice you roll and how you do it particularly, but I will say that although there is a GM in it and it's a GM game, there is a much bigger division of creative control than you'd normally have in a GM game, although it doesn't go quite as far as Hillfolk, which love it, but I look at Hillfolk and I'm like, I don't understand why there's a GM in there at all. so it doesn't get quite that far.
What's the focus of playbacks? Because like, obviously we've just done an investigation game. What do we do in...
So I think that it's quite multifaceted, actually, because the way the system works is that it's kind of skills-based, that you break down, you have a bunch of skills and a bunch of histories, and then you kind of roll them in situations where you can stretch to make them interpret it. But the more successes you have, the more open you are to things going badly wrong further down the line. I'm not going to spoil you too much for yet. But I think that there's an awful lot of things. So you are ultimately building a community. So you may be facing the sorts of things that a community may be facing. For example, maybe there's a murder. Maybe there's a bit of investigation, or maybe you have to go and find someone who's gone lost or missing, so there's kind of a slight adventure-y aspect to it, or maybe you've got to go and do some politicking with another community who've been sending you bad crops, or maybe there's a number of different political factions, and there's a real mix, actually. So some of the communities are quite high-tech, so you can play communities who are basically kind of little science pods working on high-tech science, like the memetic virus, the Tormenta, and you can play, you know, what goes wrong with them, or you can be playing people almost like a farming community who've gone back to the land who don't want to have anything to do with that. Or you can play the people who live at the spaceport on the planet and all of the politics that might come along with that. So it's quite freewheeling in terms of topic and direction of story.
Okay, this is reminding me of some TV show that we watched where people were on a colony. I can't remember the name, but it sounds good.
Anyway, so that's After the War, which I'm pretty interested in, but I'm also interested and open to other things that other people want to talk about.
Just nice work on the name. Like, naming things is hard.
Yeah.
And the song and Choristers and Tormentor, like, they're not made up words, but they fit together really nicely.
They're really resonant.
Mm.
Yeah, I think. Well, Alastair Stewart's basically just brilliant, isn't he, at writing, so.
Yes.
Did you hear that, Alistair? You're just bloody brilliant. We love you. But yeah, there's lots of kind of cool stuff. Like, the world's called Polvo, but yeah, the naming of things is very kind of just screamingly evocative.
Mm.
Done a really good job of that, which I would absolutely butcher, I'm sure, if I GM'd it.
Naming things is hard.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Should we do another one?
Yeah.
James, Sue, I've got one, but I've got six, actually.
You crack on, Nick.
Yeah, you go. I'm afraid I used to sort of try and keep up with what was current in the world of indie games, but I've been sufficiently addled by the times in which we live that my role here has to be reduced to sort of smiling and nodding.
You can bring us classics, James.
Come on, James. You are sleeping in your childhood bedroom, which is just wall-to-wall 90s throwbacks, isn't it?
Don't make James run as Mage of the Ascension.
I'm not going to make him run Amber Diceless.
I don't think I'm capable of that. I don't think I'm cruel enough to do Amber Diceless. It's going to have to be a nominee, guys.
Oh, but I love a nominee!
I once played in a nominee game where I got locked in a washing machine. It was great.
Was that the Innominé Paranoia mashup game that our friend ran for us?
I think it might have been, yeah.
There's probably at least one angelic faction that, like, recharges their powers by being locked in a washing machine.
Well, I would definitely play Innominé. I mean, I know nothing about whether it's any good of a game, but the concept is very grabby.
Yeah, I think, you know,
James is really offering it.
No. in those 90s games... actually, is Innominate, has there been a reboot of Innominate? Because, like, everything else, like, pretty much literally everything else from that period that you can think of has had some, you know, recent Kickstarter reboot. And I thought that, like, Tribe 8 was, like, the last holdout, but then there has now been a reboot of Tribe 8. I'm not seeing anything on the Wikipedia page. So that's it. In Nominee is the last holdout 90s game not to be rebooted.
What's the one you like, Josh? Immortal?
Oh, Immortal, The Invisible War.
Has that been rebooted?
Yeah, turns out that Paul Beakley off the Indie Game Reading Club community actually wrote for it. Didn't know that. Anyway, yeah, no, that's an amazing game. It's the absolute quintessential 90s kitchen sink mashup. You play like immortal characters who've lived through the ages, and they kind of periodically go to sleep and lose their memories and think they're mortal and then come back again, and they've all got animal spirits that give them powers, and also they can sing to the universe to make it do what they want it to, and also there are special realms that they can live in which will simulate different periods of history, and also every single one of them's got a shard of a dead god inside them, and also and also and also. It just goes on and on and on. It's just,
are there not dinosaurs in it as well?
Surely.
Yes, one of the baddies, so when the immortals were first created in the late Cretaceous, some of the dinosaurs got turned into like mega powerful immortals called the Abzulim, who forged a massive star-spanning empire, and then for reasons unknown went into decline, but are obviously still lurking in the background ready to fuck you over. It's an amazing game, but I mean also terrible in that it's impossible to understand the game because it's so vast and incoherent. So if someone were to reboot that, that'd be amazing, and I would definitely run it.
I feel like if you ever say you play Immortals Who, you can go, yep, 90s.
Yeah, I mean it's a you remember someone did that game Katanas and Trench Coats.
Yeah.
I mean that is it is this game is it's totally people walking around with trench coats under which is concealed a katana, for sure.
So a correction to my earlier statement, in Nominee, as experts will be aware, was originally a French game, and the French game has had a crowdfunded 2015 reboot. So it is back, but we would have to play it in French.
Was it written by a guy called Croc? Did I remember that right?
That sounds familiar, yes.
90s.
It was the best of times and the worst of times.
Pause to allow Sue to disclaim that she's not going to offer any games.
Well, I've got my copy of Seven Wonders, which I have been flipping through again.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I love those games.
Yeah, and our talk of like sci-fi and stuff has made me think of Rise and Fall, which is a very lovely game I played with the Slack group.
I've heard the game design is quite cool.
Obviously, that can be set in whatever genre we want. And it's quite fun as a little one-shot type thing, so if people were up for that, then that'd be cool.
I love Rise and Fall, so I'm definitely up for playing it. That's the one where you create a dystopia and then rip it down, isn't it? And chart the rise and fall of it, so yeah, totally, totally up for that.
Yeah, interestingly, that game was written about the same time as Downfall, which is a very similar concept, so they just arise completely in parallel.
Mm.
There's not very many people know that.
There is another sci-fi game in the book, Nemesis 382, but I feel like because it involves decks of cards, it might be a bit less conducive for playing online. There's a lot of cards by the looks of it, but it's a cool premise. You're getting closer and closer to a black hole, and things go weird essentially as the closer you get to it. So
I do really like black hole fuckery.
Didn't we start playing a black hole game with Joe and Liz?
Maybe?
We played one session of it.
I feel we played a Lovecraft Death game with a black hole in it as well.
Are you thinking of Kiss Her Before the World Ends?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Ah.
I think we played a game of that where there was a black hole in it, because black holes are really cool.
Black holes are awesome.
There were black holes in my PhD thesis.
Oh my god. Was it exactly like Event Horizon?
Oh, totally.
Oh.
I mean, even with Sam Neill, you know.
Oh, a bit disappointed now. It's one of my favourite films.
I mean, I hope your PhD thesis was just illustrated with little pictures from Event Horizon. That'd be great. Just with no explanation and nothing to do with the text.
Chapter headers or something.
Was there a bit in the thesis that quotes the best line in Event Horizon? Did you think you could break all the laws of physics and there wouldn't be a price to pay?
Oh god, missed opportunity. Do another one.
I've just realised Sam Neill has been in so many of my favourite sci-fi films, because Jurassic Park is obviously.
I knew you were going to say that.
Love Jurassic Park. I've seen it like 12 times, and I can still
watch
it tomorrow.
Well, I just got pause to say that I nearly suggested my own game, Disaster Strikes, as a possible game we could play, which was I think maybe the first game I designed actually, and therefore probably not very good. I would have to say it's the reason I didn't suggest it, where you set up like a disaster zone, and then it's got a kind of mechanic for the disaster getting bigger and bigger and worse, and you have to kind of escape rescuing as many people as possible, and it's like one of the things it can do is simulate Jurassic Park.
Does Escape from Dino Island also do that? Because I've never played that and I'm very interested to.
It's on my list.
Oh my god!
Segway.
Yeah, tell us about that, Nick.
Yeah, so Escape from Dino Island. I mean, it's Jurassic Park the RPG.
I'm sold.
Sam Tung and Sam Roberts. It's a PBTA. It's, I
are
think
those
from
designers
the...
or the characters who are going to be eaten by dinosaurs?
No, both. Sam Tung and Sam Roberts are the designers, the two Sams. And I think it was from the original Zine Quest, the first Zine Quest. And it's cool. It's a PBTA game designed for essentially one-shots, one or two-session games. And It's got some really gorgeous play sheets. Sam Tung is a full disclosure, he's an artist. He drew Belly Laugh for Stealing the Throne. I love his stuff. But it's also got this kind of really interesting mechanic in it where you learn about the characters as you play, called tell a story. And so there's a set of moves for when you're in the middle of action, but then there's a set of sort of quiet time moves, like the moves when you're preparing before the action. And whenever you take one of those moves, you tell a story about yourself. And each playbook has a different set of kind of story prompts that you use to tell stories about who you are. So across the arc of the show, the movie, essentially, you learn about all these characters just in time for them to be devoured by dinosaurs or get off the island. It's really quite clever. I like it a lot. It is Jurassic Park, the RPG.
I do love Jurassic Park a lot.
I like any game that allows us to use our kids' books as source material. We have a lot of dinosaur books.
So many dinosaurs.
There's actually a 2-page spread in the back of the zine of types of dinosaur.
Who's going to need that? They've already got like 100 dinosaur books. Surely everybody has those.
Each of the there's like a sidebar on each of the playbooks that just gives you a bit of flavor that is appropriate to the playbook. And so if you're playing the paleontologist, there's just dinosaur facts down one side of the playbook so that you can just throw dinosaur facts in. I think there's Morse code.
It's going to be a fight over who gets to be the paleontologist, I'm afraid.
Yeah, everyone's the paleontologist. I think there might even be dinosaur jokes on the kid playbook.
The do you think he saw us?
I have never played any of the. Sorry, jumping backwards. I have never played any of the games in Seven Wonders, and would dearly love to.
Really, I think I've played nearly all of them.
Well, the two of you pop up as playtesters for a few of them.
Yeah, I've been trying to be quite quiet because I feel like I've got a bit of skin in the game on that Seven Wonders book. We playtested all of them apart from Lynn Hardy's, I think, because it came in a bit later.
Which one? Is that Small Things?
Small Things.
I love the sound of Small Things.
I've always wanted to play it so I can complete the set. So if you wanted to run Small Things, I'd be really up for that. But then I also love Rise and Fall, and I love Black Holes.
Are they all one-shots?
Pretty much.
Roughly, yeah. I don't think... I mean, they're not designed for campaigns or anything like that.
Some of them feel like they might be more campaign-friendly than others, but they definitely feel... Yeah, they're one-shotty.
Just work our way through all of them, in between other things.
Played in the LARP version of... Now, I'm... I think I can get the terminology right here. The tabletop version in Seven Wonders is Before the Storm, and then the LARP version was Dawnstone, which was fun. But I haven't done it as a tabletop thing, only as a LARP derivative.
I have not played Before the Storm. That is, it turns out, now it's two that I haven't played out of the seven, and that's one of them. And I really like the sound of it, so.
I definitely played Before the Storm, and it was brilliant.
Turn this into a Seven Wonders podcast.
Nothing wrong with that.
No.
I don't have skin in the game.
So I have a few more things to mention. I'm going to mention Sig City of Blades next because I've missed the opportunity to do the segue from a Jason Pitch game to a Jason Pitch game. And so that opportunity's gone forever and I may as well just get on with it. So Sig City of Blades is it's Planescape. With the serial numbers filed off, that's the first thing. And it's the second such game that Jason Pitcher has written, by the way. It's a sort of version with a completely different system, and this is a new one. But anyway, so anyone who doesn't know, which I imagine is probably not very many people, because it's very, very popular with anyone who has nostalgia for...
The 90s?
It's another 90s nostalgia fest.
You play immortals who...
who wear trench coats and drink katanas. It's a multi-planar city. So kind of a city in an unknown location that connects to lots of different dimensional planes. And it's the kind of... It's the D&D style plane. So you've got the plane of fire and plane of ice. But you've also got various hells and heavens. And also individual prime material worlds that are all connected to the city by portals. And because of that, the city is full of immigrants from all over the cosmos, and it is run by various extremely weird factions. Partly weird because it's connected to so many weird places, and partly because the places it's connected to influence it via a sort of osmosis. So when the city is strongly connected to the plane of fire, things go all kind of fiery, and the philosophies and attitudes of the plane of fire start to invade the city, and also, of course, you get lots of denizens of the plane of fire seeping in. So it's kind of frothing with lots of weirdness. And then what Jason's done is he's basically sort of dropped Blades in the Dark into that setting, and that's makes it sound like he's just taken Blades in the Dark, which he hasn't. He's thoroughly hacked it to produce lots of really interesting mechanical innovations and weird crews. So I should probably say, so Blades in the Dark is, for anyone who doesn't know, the original Forged in the Dark game. It's about playing a crew of thieves carrying out heists, and the game's like ultra optimized for that, with lots of cool mechanics for allowing you to do a heist with no planning. And he's just taken that and made it kind of planescapey. So you'll all be playing these weird races from God knows where across the plains. You'll all have some sort of weird belief system, religion, philosophy, because that's what Planescape's like, and what SIG is like, is full of weird religions and philosophies. And you'll all have a third thing. I can't remember what the third thing is. You're, instead of having one playbook, you're kind of made out of three elements anyway. And you play a crew who commit, I mean, I'm not going to say heists, but it looks like it could be heists. But instead of it just being to make money, it's to further the interests of your weird planar faction that you work for, who might be the celestial librarians or the keepers of the corpses or something. You know, they'll be kind of weird and esoteric. So yeah, Sig City of Blades, I think it looks like a really fun, and it looks cool enough that it's made me willing to try Forged in the Dark again, and that's saying a lot.
Is this where I drop in my Forged in the Dark game?
Please.
Seems like an excellent segue.
First of all, I would love to play that at some point. Crash Cart is mine. Crash Cart by Galen Peugeot. I'm a big fan of this game and would love to play more of it. So it's a game about working stiffs on a private ambulance in a near future cyberpunk California. So California's cyberpunk, the patients are cyberpunk, you're just a bunch of working Joes with very little of that cyberpunkiness about you. And so each session is a shift. And it's about piling into your emergency medical vehicle and flying out to your weird and wonderful private clients, and then snatching little bits of downtime in between, kind of a medical drama in that sort of cyberpunky future. It's also a Forged in the Dark game, but it's a pretty heavy drift. Galen calls it the pressure deck system. It swaps out the dice for a deck of cards, and the deck depletes across the course of your shift. So, you know, it's the dwindling energy and resources of your overworked crew of medicos across the course of the night, just trying to get through without getting sued, shot, or losing any patients.
I was just going to say, is it a comedy game? Is it like, because you could play that dead straight, or you could play it comedy, or a mix of both, right?
Yeah, I don't think it's intended as a comedy game. I think some of the patients are sort of pretty outsized and so could lean that way if you so wanted them to. I mean, so while we're talking about skin of the game, I've written a patient for the game who was for Galen, who was just a really obnoxious cashed up rich guy, and the art that Galen produced for the patient looks alarmingly like a well known, a very famous, obnoxious rich person. You'll see it as soon as you look at it.
You're definitely going to have to be more specific.
It's Rupert Murdoch. So, yeah, but and he does some really interesting stuff. Galen always does really interesting stuff with play sheets. Like, he's an artist as well as a game designer, and so in addition to the play sheet, you know, the sheets for your characters and for your emergency medical vehicle, there are also patient sheets, which make it essentially a zero prep Forged in the Dark game. Like, you draw a patient sheet, you deal out a couple of cards, and you've got the situation that you've got to throw your poor med techs into.
That is very cool.
You know, I'm generally too hypochondriac and squeamish for medical drama, but is all of this like, oh, you know, the firmware on their implants needs updating?
It could very well be that, yeah. It depends on the patients that you choose to play, but many of them are that kind of stuff. I think the intention, I mean, you could play it however you so chose, but I don't think anybody's expecting it to get medical. Your job is to get out there, pick him up and get him to a hospital and keep him alive, right? So,
okay.
You know, you might be a medic, but you're not a doctor.
I think it sounds really good. I have to say, I really rate Galen as a designer.
I've
come across him in a game jam. I think it might have been a game jam I ran, but anyway, I can't remember which one it was, but he wrote a sort of a PG Roadhouse game as part of this game jam, and as you say, he's an artist and he does layout, so the game that he submitted was both beautiful and also well designed and well written. So it was, yeah, I have full confidence based on that one game that Crash Cart will be awesome.
That said, James, if you have a medical squick, then we can push that down the list or whatever.
Well, like I say, it depends on the details.
The game from the jam, I think, was Tales from the Junior Ganymede Club. And, get in on Galen's playtests, playtest packet things, because, I mean, he sells them as if they're playtests, but they are the most gorgeous playtests you'll ever see. Bargains.
Very unfair that he's able to do all those things.
True fact. I also have a lightning round, considering the time, if we want a lightning round. Just a few suggestions that popped up on Twitter and abouts.
Yeah, cool. Do it.
Pick through quick, but if somebody else has...
So I have one more thing I want to mention, and I can do it before or after the lightning round, doesn't matter.
I say go before. Too much me talking.
All right. So I was just going to pitch for running something in the esque category of games, so because I love them, and because partly because we started the whole thing off. So obviously Lovecraft-esque second edition, we're currently playtesting and is in a good playable state. You all know this, but it's cosmic horror where you GMlessly create the horror yourself, so you're not drawing on Lovecraft's bestiary so much as the sort of general vibe of his games, but with the racism stripped out. There's also Bleak Spirit, which I love. That's by Chris Longhurst. Brilliant Dark Souls clone, which takes the same sort of premise, and instead of building up Lovecraftian horror, it builds up some sort of weird fantastical landscape with a horrible boss monster that you fight at the end. Absolute genius. And there's a couple of other games that we've written in this vein. Elementary, where you competitively create a cozy murder mystery, or Toadstone, Becky's folk horror game, where you don't know whether the horror's going to be the quaint little villagers, or the hooded visitor, or the evil fog that surrounds the village. And the other one I thought we might look at was The Soul Survivor, which I know very little about, based on Chinese myth, by W.H. Arthur. Looks really cool, and I've been dying to try it for a while. So, yeah, if anybody fancies doing one of those, I'd be well up for facilitating. There you go. I did a lightning round. Now you can have your lightning round.
Yes to all of the above. I particularly would love to play Bleak Spirit sometime. I haven't had the opportunity, and I really like its vibe. Okay, so lightning round. These are just a couple of games that people suggested. I think in response to a tweet that you sent out, Josh, that I'm familiar with. It's really just a random selection. These are just the ones I know. So the first one's Heterodoxy by Calvin Johns. And this one was published in the Indie Zine in the December 2020 issue. So the Indie Zine is a co-op of game designers, of indie game designers. They put out a magazine quarterly with games and articles and supplements and all kinds of fun stuff. There's a Crochet Heroes comic that's been serialized over a bunch of them, that photographic comic. It's kind of amazing. And in fact, the December 2020 issue was the one that Stealing the Throne appeared in first. So I shared the zine with Heterodoxy and Calvin. So there is a potential trigger warning here, in that it is a game about child soldiers. Although I think you could crank the age up a little bit. I mean, it's kind of baked into the premise, but it's a Romanesque empire that kind of dominates everything, but is never on entirely on screen, and a heretic from that empire who has fled to the faraway place where you all live and trained children to fight the empire. And so it plays out with kind of procedurally generated ventures to take on the empire. But it's the whole time these child soldiers are trying to resist going too far and becoming chimera that the empire will then turn against your own people. And along the way, the kind of rhythm of the campaign is that you're learning about this heretic who, you know, has come out here and built child soldiers. Yeah, so kind of heavy stuff, but really interesting, I think. So that's one. The second one is Odd Jobs by Sasha Sienna and Jonathan Sims. And I think this one could be kind of fun for us, actually, because it's actually a series of systemless micro settings and adventures associated with those micro settings. And they're all a bit weird. I don't know, there's maybe 10 of them or something. So the first one is Ghostbusters in space. The idea being that if you die in space, you can't pass on. So somebody has to go out there, collect your ghost and bring it back to Earth so that you can pass on. There's a cruise ship lost in the Bermuda Triangle. There's one about gods are real, religions are startups, and worship is mediated by like a stock exchange. All kinds of really cool, weird stuff.
Too real, man. Too real.
Yeah. But I think it could be really fun for us, actually. I mean, a bit of lead time, but it might be fun to build little games based around these micro settings, you know?
Oh my God. Yeah, why doesn't nobody do a jam to build the system for this setting?
It's pretty new. It kickstarted just recently. I don't even know if it's made it into print yet. The PDF is out, but the art is gorgeous too. Like there's a really serious kind of Hellboy vibe to the Ghostbusters in Space one, which I love. Same two authors for each micro setting, but different artists for each one. So they've all got their own kind of feel. Yeah, it's really cool. And then the third one I wanted to mention is Ark by Momotos. So this is I haven't finished reading this one yet, but this comes from the RPGC, all of the kind of really interesting design that's happening in Southeast Asia at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're doing amazing work in RPGC.
And so much of it is so beautiful. This book is a really prime example. It's really gorgeous.
Yeah, I've seen a copy of Ark and it's just jaw-droppingly beautiful.
Yeah, and all the more impressive because, like Galen, Momotos has done the design, the writing, the art and the layout on the thing. It's a fantasy game about an apocalypse. You know, the end is coming. Some kind of big doom is coming and you're squaring off against it. And its trick is that the doom approaches in real time. So you decide that you're playing X number of sessions, 1 to 3 sessions. You set a timer, a real timer. And then after 30 minutes has elapsed, the doom draws closer. And then the next 30 minutes, it draws closer again. So you're on the clock, literally.
I do love that sort of shtick.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's no, it doesn't advance linearly. It can jump on you. So you never know for sure when it's going to arrive.
That sounds good.
And there's a really lovely little bit in the where you know, when the end comes, you can make a choice about how you're going to wrap up your game. Either epilogue, you know, it happened, or move on to whatever big thing comes after this one. You know, some new world is born and another doom arrives or something. Or take all of the things that you've learnt, rewind, and try it again. It's not without cost. So there are costs when you do that, but you pick a point back in your doomsday clock and start again. Just try and fix it.
Oh, that's really super interesting.
Yeah. So that was my lightning round. Those were three things that people suggested that I think are really quite cool.
So I want to mention something that someone suggested that hasn't been mentioned, and I hoped somebody would mention it, but you've all failed me. So now, if you want a job doing, you have to do it yourself. And that is Becky's game, History Dig Life, which was suggested by Grant Howitt, and is a great little game where you play TV archaeologists. If you've watched Time Team, it's that. If not, it's TV archaeologists. What more do you want? And you flash back and forth between scenes of the TV archaeologists where you essentially improvise nonsense about some piece of archaeology that you found together and kind of debate each other about what the archaeology you found means. And then you flash back to scenes of the past in which we find out what it really meant and what the characters who lived in that place like what their lives were like. And I like it because I want to play my archaeologist who is played by Brian Blessed again. And that's, to be honest, I might play Brian Blessed in whatever game we pick just because no one can stop me.
Checks out.
The other thing I wanted to mention, because nobody's picked it up, is I know, and I know it's late, so if anybody wants to just say, no, shut up, Josh. Becky's pulling a bit of a face that says, shut up, Josh.
I'm a bit tired. How quick are you going to be, Josh?
Well, I'll just say it, and then we can decide how, whether it's too, too much. Nobody has mentioned any Belonging Outside Belonging games, and I know that Nick is really keen to play a Belonging Outside Belonging game.
So keen.
It's not...
I really want to play Balak Bayan.
It does look really good.
Flotsam has come up before, I think, a couple of times, hasn't it?
That got mentioned in the Twitter as well, but I've heard the design is not very good, so...
Oh, right, well, fuck it then.
Yeah, I'd love to play Flotsam.
Say where you'd like to play Flotsam, Nick. I mean, I just for the fun of it.
So, I mean, on the higher level Belonging Outside Belonging thing, I think it's a design space that I'd really like to do some work in, and... In order to feel like I can really do that work, I'd like to have actually physically played them rather than, you know, just have played them in my head, see how it feels in practice. Flotsam is a, which I have never played, is a game about the, I think it's a game about the ordinary run-of-the-mill people living their lives on board a space station. It's the down below from Babylon 5. It's the, what is it called in Deep Space Nine? The promenade? Is that what it's called in Deep Space Nine? Yeah, those the ordinary people who live in those stations, I think in the shadow of probably great stuff happening. How am I doing, Josh?
Yeah, you're spot on. Although the great stuff is usually a bit dystopian in all the games I've played, but like it's kind of up to you, right?
Well, I mean, the down below is pretty dystopian in Babylon 5, I think.
No, I meant the shiny stuff on top. Ah, like, okay. I don't think I've ever played a game where people didn't go lean fascist on that, but it might have just been the people I was playing with. I don't know.
Yeah, the people you're playing with lean fascist, is that what you...
Yes, I like to play with fascists. No, I mean,
lean anti-fascist.
You've got the above and the below, right?
Right.
And the above usually turns out to be a bit fashy, and then the below are the people who are being oppressed by the mean fascists, and that's who you play. You don't play the fascists.
I am definitely interested in Flotsam. However, I also feel, for full disclosure, I should mention that me and James are currently in a Flotsam game.
With a very specific aesthetic, I believe.
Synthwave cyberpunk Flotsam, somewhat drifted from its original, brought down to earth.
It's very sweet and neon.
People are going to be clamoring for this hack, James. I mean, it's synthwave, really cyberpunk, Flotsam. It's gold.
Yeah, but so I mean, the hack basically consists of the words synthwave, cyberpunk, Flotsam. That was the work that I did there, the engineering.
You made a playlist for us, didn't you?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so if at a later date we want to bring Belonging Outside Belonging back to the table, I'll bring a reading list and we can just select from the reading list.
That'd be cool. I really love Belonging Outside Belonging. I played Dream Askew and absolutely loved it, and it made that made me write Flotsam because it's such a cool framework. So yeah, cool. Well, like, I guess we're gonna have to go away and decide what we're gonna play. We haven't got time now to tell you all, listeners, what it is, so I'm really sorry about that. You're just gonna have to wait and see.
You can tweet your picks from the list at us.
Yeah, and definitely,
although if you do, by the time you've got around to doing so, we'll already have started playing whatever it is. So
yeah, I didn't say we were going to pay any attention.
Maybe it's more like a sweepstake. What do you think we're going to end up playing?
Yeah.
And in what order?
And, you know, quantum physics says that until you observe it, we haven't really played the game anyway. We're playing all of those games simultaneously. Thank you for listening to Black Armada Tales. If you'd like to know more about the games that we discussed in this episode, there are links to all of them in the show notes. And don't forget to rate and review the podcast and join us on Twitter, where we are B Armada Tales. See you next time.
I was explaining to Josh last night that When I was at university, we went to the same uni, but when I was at uni, all the people studying English literature at uni had to spend like a term learning how to translate pre-Chaucerian English. And it turned out it's because J.R.R. fucking Tolkien had put it on the syllabus and nobody had ever dared to take it off again. And so these poor English students had to spend a whole term doing some ridiculously archaic thing that was never any use to them and wasn't particularly interesting either, because J.R.R. Tolkien insisted that every English lit student had to have a thorough grounding in pre-Chaucerian English.
Thanks, Gerald Roger Roger.
Indeed.
I haven't read Chaucer, but isn't Chaucerian English itself quite hard?
Yeah, I did that at A-level, though. Surely you did some short... Did you? Oh, you know you didn't do an English history A-level. No, you usually do a bit of Chaucer, and I did. Actually, really enjoyed doing Chaucer at A-level, because Chaucer's quite bawdy.
Yes, I've seen his Twitter account.
He is very bawdy, and it was quite fun, as a 18-year-old, learning how to translate all the filth... in Chaucer. I did The Wife of Bath, which is a particularly filthy one. I always liked it as well because The Wife of Bath is described as gap-toothed, which is an indication of how incredibly sexy she is. And I have gap teeth in the same way that she did.
So Geoffrey Chaucer would have been like, fuck yeah.
No, not sexy in that way. Not sexy and attractive. Sexy as in, oh, what's the right word?
Fertile?
No. Rampant.
Oh, horny?
Yeah. As in, she, you know, joyfully put it about and got a lot of it. And she's quite old as well. Like, the Wife of Bath is supposed to be like 60 or something.
You mean a trollop? That's what you mean.
No, I don't, because that's a gendered slur. You can put that in the stinger, Josh. I'm recording all of this.
Yeah, that's fine. I don't mind. No, but, like... So are you saying Geoffrey Chaucer was not using it in a...
No, he wasn't using it in a pejorative way.
Negative way. Oh, he's just like, oh, it's cool. She's, you know, I know that if I want to shag, the gap-toothed girl will be there for me.
She wasn't a girl. She was like in her 60s. She'd been through many husbands and lovers.
Girl in the broadest possible sense.
Hmm.
Well, as you can see, I don't know any Chaucerian...
We have the complete works of Chaucer upstairs, if you want to dig in.
I do not.
Okay.
Or do I?
I quite enjoyed Chaucer, but it's hard to get into because it's Chaucerian English, which needs a bit of translating.
The BBC did a bunch of modern adaptations.
Oh yeah,
a while ago now. But I think Julie Walters is the wife.
She was the wife of Bath. Yeah, she was brilliant.
She got a gap tooth.
I don't know, but she bonked everything that moved in that movie, especially younger men. The wife of Bath liked younger men.
Fair enough.
And she was a wealthy, independent widow, so she could kind of do what the fuck she liked. And did.
Is that why you were struggling for words, Becky? Because you realised that all the words for a woman who likes to put it about a bit were negative?
Yes. Mm. Were she a man, I'd have had a feast of words.
Would you?
Stud, stallion, player. I don't think there's more than that.
So I don't think all of... Oh, player, I suppose, yeah. Like, I wouldn't have said stallion necessarily means someone who puts it about a bit. It's more like kind of a sexy... man, but I see what you mean. I know what you mean.
James
I just
is missing for this quality, I know, right? Conversation, because I bet he's got an opinion on fucking Chaucer,
right?
You know,
I keep feeling we're missing somebody else apart from James, but we're not. I just can't count.
Can you hear us, James? You're tapping your microphone.
The entire Chaucer conversation was usable.
That I was recording appropriately from the headset mic. Yes.
What's your view on Chaucer?
My view on Chaucer.
Yes.
Quite good. It's been some time since I read any Chaucer. I have an edition. So William Morris and Edward Burne Jones, sometime towards the end of their lives, I think, certainly Morris's life in the 1890s, did the Kelmscott Press edition of Chaucer, a wonderful piece of book production with, you know, woodcut plates or some similar technique by Burne Jones and... floral illustrated borders by Morris, lovely although somewhat unreadable font work, and I have a facsimile edition sitting around, I think still in my house in Cambridge. Lovely thing to look at, not terribly practical to read. I've never read the Canterbury Tales end to end, but I've read, you know, big chunks. You can just about make sense of it with a marginal gloss. Yeah, you know, it's good bits and bad bits, but when there's, you know, bits that are about, like, monks farting or something, that's pure gold. Was that the sort of response you were hoping for?
So a lot of that was quite garbled because of your terrible internet connection, but the line "a lot of stuff about monks farting" was alarmingly clear.
Now, don't forget, Becky, you can get the benefit of both sides of this conversation by listening to the podcast.
I know. I'm looking forward to listening back to it because I knew that James would have something interesting to say.
You'll discover what our conversation was about. I was trying to explain the Kelmscott Press edition.
It sounded really nice, the bits that I heard.
Don't try to re-explain it. All the listeners have already heard it, James.
No, don't re-explain it.
Becky
has to listen to the podcast if she wants to know. That's it.
I will.
It's like an Easter egg for her.
Chaucer and I like James. Yeah.
I'll just drop a Google Images link for the Kelmscott edition of Chaucer into the chat. That's completely useless for the listeners.
Yes, please.
Although it is useful for the listeners because if they just type Kelmscott Chaucer into Google Images, they can see pretty much the same thing.
James, if you post the link into the Slack channel, I will happily put it in the show notes. I'm certainly planning on putting links to any games we mention in the show notes.
So why not a little bit of Chaucer as well?
Why the fuck not? I mean, someone might write a Chaucer jam, why not? Get mechanics based on the width of the gap in your teeth and how much sex you can have. People remove, actually get the teeth removed in order to get to hack the game, min-max their character.
Seems a bit extreme, but I can go with that.